All right, I'm going to introduce our guests tonight and a sterling panel of musicians who participated in Songs from Scratch. First, he's an exquisite songwriter, founder of the Honey Dogs, our songwriting guide, Mr. Adam Levy. Next up, hailing from Crosby, Minnesota, except for the drummer who's from Milwaukee, put your hands together for Best Friends Forever. Our next artist is, I believe, from Charleston, South Carolina, but we as Minnesotans have named him and claimed him. He is Jeremy Messersmith. Last but certainly not least, Doomtree is in the house, courtesy of Steph Alexander, a.k.a. POS. This is an event I have been looking forward to for so many weeks because I think everybody in this room probably has a really powerful relationship with music in some way, with songs, with the art of songwriting. We're really curious about it. Some of us even practice the art of songwriting. And I think we have perhaps a one-of-a-kind opportunity to really get down and talk about it and dissect songs and explore songwriting. And we have some of the best practitioners in the area right here, so you're going to get a chance to take advantage of that as well. And I should remind you, unless you were under a rock, you probably are aware of the fact that we aired a special series this past week. That was kind of rude of me to say, wasn't it? Under a rock? What did I mean by that? That's really arrogant. Maybe you heard it, maybe you didn't. But it was great. Songs from Scratch. And if you didn't hear it, I'll quickly fill you in. Adam Levy was our songwriting guide, and we asked him to pick a well-known story. He chose The Wizard of Oz. Good choice. And we also asked him to write a few lines that all of these other artists would incorporate into their respective songs. And they did it in great fashion. And then we recruited these musicians, Best Friends Forever, Jeremy Messersmith, and POS. And their challenge was to write the song, incorporate the lines, and they had 2 weeks. Now, let me just say something about Songs from Scratch, and I don't mean to alarm you. That was then, this is now, man. It's over. We're going to use Songs from Scratch to expand the conversation, to talk about the nature of songwriting, delve into it a little bit further, as I said before. In fact, we're going to try to boil down songwriting to its essence. I think we can do it. So, Josh, roll tape, please.
Songwriting is...
Songwriting is speaking from the heart.
I have no idea what songwriting is.
A way to stop sweating other things.
Songwriting is challenging.
It's very useful.
Songwriting is fun.
Really fun.
Songwriting is my life.
Best ever.
Songwriting is not something everyone likes to do.
Songwriting is...
But it's something that everyone can do.
Songwriting is as varied as the human existence. Yeah.
Wow, profound. I recognize those voices. Do you? Let me tell you briefly why I recognize them, because for weeks and weeks and weeks, I listened to them talking over and over and over again in a little cramped studio on the third floor, and it was rewarding nonetheless. So we're going to dig a little deeper into their brains in just a little bit, but we're going to start with some music first. In Detroit, we say, let's kick out the jams. Ladies and gentlemen, Best Friends Forever.
Interstate highway system, and my song is just a way to
to pay a little tribute to him just on that road. My true love and I rode from Ohio to Pittsburgh and our separate cars gave me the time to think of ways to try to kiss him. Our separate hearts beat at a time without someone to find the rhythm of the last. I thought I felt them simultaneously quicken.
Best friends forever. That song is called Eisenhower is the Father.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Have you guys ever thought about putting a curriculum together for like a high school civics course?
I don't think we give too much actual information about Eisenhower and that song. That
I guess you're right.
But it's in the works, nonetheless.
We say the name of a historical figure.
I just love the way you reference my home state, Michigan. Can you tell the story behind this song?
Well, I think I had just fallen in love with someone from Michigan. Is that why we say that? Are you asking about the whole song?
Well, it all starts. It's a tour song. We are inspired by touring and traveling, and so we started that song while on the road, not going to Michigan, but we're just coming from Michigan. So we just had this great image of the great state of Michigan, but we did see the sign that said Eisenhower is the father of the interstate highway system, and it had just screamed song, so the melody came, and there it was. So
for some reason, it was the way that sentence, Eisenhower is the father of the interstate highway system, it was just really musical, and we both had it stuck in our heads, even though it didn't have a melody or anything on the sign that it was written on. And I think we'd come to a really awkward point with the people that were touring in the car with us, so we were trying to find any way to make it fun. So we were just singing whatever was in our heads, and then it turned into a song.
This is Jess Siemens, by the way, and Bree Smith, and Joe Rand on drums. And Jess, is it usually your love interest that propels the songwriting process, or is it Bree's?
That's a good question. I think we're talking about two love interests in that song, one for each of us.
Mm-hmm. There's usually enough to go around.
Yeah. There's definitely, each song is probably referring to multiple people. I think we have very few songs that are about just one love interest.
Well, I am so happy you played that song. Come on over here, okay. Join us, okay. Sit in your chairs. I'm going to bring Jeremy Messersmith into the mix. Jeremy, I'm walking at you, but I'm only going to get this close.
Okay.
Because I know this is your performance space, and you need your space.
It's sacred over here.
It is. Okay, we're going to do the opposite of what we did with BFF. I want you to tell us what you're going to play and talk about it. a little bit.
Okay. This is a song that I wrote fairly recently. It's called A Girl, A Boy, and a Graveyard. And I mean, that's pretty much what the whole song's about, I guess.
Wow. I don't think we need any more than that.
Okay, I'll just get right into it.
Jeremy Messersmith.
Lucy takes the long way home. Meets me in a field of stones. She says, I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. My body's cold, my guts are twisting steel. And I feel like I'm some kind of Frankenstein, waiting for a shock to bring me back to life. But I don't want to spend my time waiting for lightning to strike. Underneath the concrete sky, Lucy puts her hand in mine. She says that life's a game we're meant to lose, but stick by me and I will stick by you. Cause I'm like a princess in a castle high, waiting for a kiss to bring me back to life. But I don't wanna spend my time waiting for just another guy.
Wow, that was beautiful, beautiful.
Thanks.
I'm just really curious. It seems like you're a songwriter who tends to write from your own experience, not necessarily autobiographically, but from your own experience, and that seems like more of a short story about characters that you've created.
Yeah, one of my goals in writing the song was to try to write a song that has characters that maybe people identify with. And it was kind of inspired from actually seeing Juno, Diablo Cody's movie. And I was just curious how in the world she made all the characters so incredibly likable. So I tried writing a song kind of like that.
And they're likable in a graveyard.
Yeah, well, you know, I spend a lot of time in graveyards, you know. So, hey.
One of the things I learned about Jeremy over the course of Songs from Scratch is that he has not necessarily a strange ritual, but I think a unique one of doing copious amounts of research on whatever subject he is writing a song about, and he fills volumes and volumes of spiral notebooks. What the heck is going on? That sounds like so much work, Jeremy.
Yeah, it kind of does, now that you mention it, but it was interesting listening to how everybody started, you know, and apparently I have kind of the Hardy Boys approach to writing a song, so
to the library. That's our stop. I don't know.
Have you ever asked a librarian to help you, in writing a song?
I should. It'd probably be helpful.
Well, we're talking about ritual, I guess, now, and that's something I want to turn the conversation toward, and all of you panelists, think about rituals that you may or may not have in the course of writing songs. And I'll ask you a few questions in a little bit, but before I do, we're going to hear some other notable songwriters talk about their songwriting processes and rituals. And first, Ms. Fiona Apple.
I never sit down and try to write songs. I just kind of walk around a lot with things in my head, and I like to rearrange the words and make them so that if I say them, the rhythm is fun to say, and the sounds of the words bounce off each other in a certain way. And I'll do that without writing anything down until there's like a verse or a chorus.
You guys relate to that? Interesting. That's Fiona Apple. And Tori Amos is somebody who has kind of a different take on things.
I have a sonic paint box, and instead of paints that make this up, I have rhythm phrases or a melody or a lyric that I collect along the way. The woman in the coffee shop, you know, screaming her head off. This becomes part of my palette, and I pull from this and the songs develop.
That kind of makes sense to me, a woman screaming her head off. Sounds like Tori Amos in a way. I don't know why. The drama? Maybe it's the drama. I won't go so far as to say melodrama, but the drama. And sonic paint box, that's a powerful image. All right, then there's Sheryl Crow, who has this songwriting ritual.
Go out and drink margaritas and hit all the seedy joints and then come back and work on music.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me. So what do you guys think? Do you have any rituals when you go about the process of songwriting? Adam?
When you asked that question first, I just thought, like, what's your routine like when you write a song? But I got a lot of little things I do. One thing is I just listen to a lot of music. I know when I'm going through a period where I'm listening to a lot of new music, I'm going to start writing just by virtue of kind of being stimulated by what I'm seeing other people do. Just listening to a lot of music all the time. Then what I'll do is when I start recording ideas, I won't have a song finished, but what I like to do is record it and then just drive around and sing along with it and kind of make stuff up to it. But I'm always, you know, lyrics are coming all the time, conversations I'm having with people, movies I'm watching or books I'm reading. There's little phrases that I'll invert or, you know, pilfer and use in my songs.
You look so comfortable sitting. I think I'm going to join you here.
Listen to my chair.
Do you find that lyrics come more easily to you than melodic ideas, or is it 50-50?
I'd say it's kind of 50-50. I would say early on when I was writing music, I was primarily like the guy that would just sort of hum stuff, nonsense, and all of a sudden lyrics would come and they would, you know, materialize out of nowhere. But I think as time goes on, I've sort of learned ways of creating songs without actually having a guitar or a piano, where I can be standing somewhere and a phrase comes into my head and all of a sudden I can start working with a song that way.
And a phrase comes to your head and not too soon after a melody?
Sometimes it's a phrase that comes to me that's great and then all of a sudden the poetry comes, and then sometimes it's a phrase that comes to me and then 10 years later the song comes.
You know,
it's not necessarily an instantaneous process.
Mm-hmm. Okay, best friends forever. How do you get into the zone, man?
Kind of like Adam's saying, for me at least, there's usually a line that it just shows up in my head, and usually there will be a melody as well. So then we kind of build around there, but I'd say lyrics are the most challenging part, so often we'll have this melody, and then a month or 2 months later, the rest of the words will fill in. But one ritual I have is that I have to have some sort of beat going on in order to write a song. I tried to write a song without a beat, and it doesn't happen. I need the rhythm.
So do you have like a doctor rhythm?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Drum machine. Drum machine. It can be the lamest beat. Like that one. That'll go for hours.
Why do you think you need that?
I don't know. I'm not. Well, like, I guess we are making, I mean, we are, what part of our aim in songwriting is writing songs good to dance to, and we're, so I guess maybe having that as a backbone of our song is important, and it start even that at the very beginning of the songwriting process to have that beat going is important.
Do you do anything to get into a mood to write lyrics, or is it just a matter of just sitting down and writing lines, writing words, and seeing what happens?
I can't, yeah, that doesn't work for me. I have to have the line or group of lines.
So you wait for lightning to strike?
Exactly. I can't just sit down with a piece of paper and expect anything to happen. And if I do, it's just frustrating and bad things come out of it.
But what if your record label is saying, BFF, come on, man, we need some product?
I think that actually that is what does it for us a lot, is having some kind of deadline. Like realizing, oh, we're going to go on tour in a month, maybe we should write some songs since we haven't written any songs since our tour last year. And we'll have all these beginnings, but that's what it takes to finish them.
That helps, uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I had the pleasure of spending a little time with Steph Alexander, POS, and I think I learned, but maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, that maybe part of your ritual is just going out and driving or riding your bike and listening to beats, isn't it?
That's when it's like lyric time. That's almost 100% of my ritual is, I'll have like a beat that either I made or a friend of mine made, or some sort of music or part that's in my head or something like that, and then I'll throw it in my CD player in the car, and I won't necessarily need to be driving, but I like to be in a car, so I'm no joke, for the 90% of the time I was recording my most recent record, which doesn't come out until next year, it was me in a 15-passenger white van sitting like next to a park for like hours on end, just with the CD playing like the same instrumental on repeat over and over and over again. And then, I mean, I'll drive around if I'm running errands or if I'm, you know, doing anything, and I'll have the beats playing that I'm working with. And then if any kind of like, I do the same thing where I collect lyric chunks and I think of them and send myself a text message or an email so I won't forget them. I used to carry around a big notebook, and then my phone worked. I remember the day I looked at my phone and then was like, maybe I could send myself a text message. And then I did. And I mean, I don't know anybody else who has 99 text messages in their inbox from themselves. So like after I have a whole like full inbox thing, I'll write them down on a piece of paper, or I'll drive around, and if one of them is working really well, when I'm driving around, I'll start writing, and then wherever I'm at, I'll just kind of pull over and then either pull out my phone if I have it, or a notebook, and then I'll just write songs right in my phone or in the notebook if I have it. I have one of those smartphones with buttons, and I don't like it, but ever since I started writing in it, I can't ever not have a phone like that.
Does it matter whether some of these lyrical ideas, these phrases that you jot down in text message to yourself, whether they're connected to each other in any way, or
they're usually not connected to mm-hmm. each other? Like a lot of rappers are all about like punchlines or like things that are funny or super clever, and I've never been that funny or that clever, and it's just,
oh, give me a break, man.
Think about rappers though. Like rappers always have cool stuff to just be popping out all the time, and I'm a clever guy as far as dudes go, but like I'm definitely not on par with some of like the more catchy, witty, comical rappers. I'm much more interested in having it be about something, or like have it be like the wit that I like and grabs me the most is the stuff that isn't so obvious, like, oh, that's a pun, or oh, that works. It's got to be the kind of thing where after you listen to it 9 or 10 times, you're like, oh, yeah. So those are the things. And they're never related, but they always end up working as good, like, first lines or second lines or a chorus piece, something like that. So that's what I'm collecting.
So you strive not to be literal. You're very instinctual about the whole thing.
About writing?
Yeah.
Literal, what do you mean?
Literal is just meaning exactly what you say.
I'm all about being very literal. I have a really hard time writing that way because with rap, it gets really boring. You know, there are some rappers that can do it. There's like Merce and like Too Short, I guess, if you want to listen to that kind of rap. Like there's like rappers that can say like, I was at the club, got in my car, went to the store, you know what I'm saying? And like it can make a song that makes sense, and you know, they can fill enough verse with just like A, B, A, B, A, B, and just, that just gets so boring to perform, and I only make music so I can perform it for the most part. So if I'm going to do something, even if I'm just performing it for myself, like, my favorite part is being able to, like, go do it. So I want to think of, like, rap kind of stuff, you know? So if as literal as it can be, but just trying to add as many syllables to it to make it fun as I can. So
I wanted to find out what the difference was between writing a rap tune and writing a regular song, a singer-songwriter's
regular
approach.
Regular song.
Well, no, I'm sorry.
I'm just kidding. I feel
bad.
You.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to regret that one. Well, a singer-songwriter's approach versus a rapper's approach. And I saw similarities. I don't know. I didn't see that many differences.
Yeah, I don't think it's that different at all. I think when I sit down to write a rock song or contribute to a rock song with my band or something like that, or when I make a rap song, it's like you either have words first and then you make music around it, or you have music first and you put words on it. Like, and that's pretty much, for me anyway, how it works, regardless of what you're doing. And sometimes you build them together. But when I've found that when you build them together, like if you have like part of this and part of this, it gets confusing, and sometimes it makes a really interesting song, and sometimes it just gets more complicated than it needs to. Kind of probably like writing words with no beat, and then you end up having like a verse that's like 12 and a half long, and it doesn't make any sense because you haven't been listening to the meter, you know.
Well, this is wonderful. I'm learning a lot. I want to ask another question now. I hate asking this. I've asked this a number of times on the local show, and it sounds so stupid. But you wonder what makes a good song. What makes a good song? And I know there's 5 billion different answers to that, and it varies from moment to moment and mood to mood, depending on who you are. But I just want the songwriters to start thinking about what makes a song successful. Let's put it in those terms. And before I let you answer that one, we're going to hear from somebody who I think is the king of pop, the real king of pop, and that's Barry Manilow. And here's what he thinks a songwriter needs to do in order to craft a good song.
Take a listener on a trip so that by the end of the song, you've gone somewhere with me. You know, a lot of the records that I hear are like one feeling. They start with a groove, and 3 minutes later, nothing has happened except a groove. That's not my thing.
Okay. That's Barry Manilow's take. All right, I guess we can hear what David Bowie thinks are in his songs and whether he has a common pattern in his songwriting. Mr. Bowie.
All my material over the last 30 years, there is a running thread. I mean, there is a running thread of negativity and nihilism throughout everything I've written. But I think that comes about from asking the so-called big questions, which continually have been something that both as a writer and personally have been meaningful to my life.
I could listen to that man talk for the rest of my life. That just makes me want to sigh. His voice is so beautiful. Yes. All right, last but not least, a little insight from... this is really self-absorbed on my part, but for some reason when I moved to Minnesota 19 years ago, people said I looked like Tom Waits. I do not. Do you think I look like him?
Yes, absolutely.
I have kind of a complex about that. Anyway, a little insight from Tom Waits.
I liked songs with the names of towns in them and something to eat. There's a certain anatomical aspect to a song that I respond to. I think, oh, yeah, I can go into that world. There's something to eat. There's the name of a street. Okay, yeah, there's a saloon. Okay.
Jeremy, is there something to eat where you go in your songs?
I think there will be in my next song.
What elements, Jeremy, make a good Jeremy Messersmith song? What does it have to contain before you say, all right, ship it, it's ready?
I think kind of the main thing is this something that I am not going to feel like I'm wasting everybody's time if I'm playing it in front of them?
But that sounds like your insecurity talking.
Yep. Yeah, no, insecurity is an integral part of my songwriting process. I try to shoot for melodies that are at least hummable, you know? So, I don't know. I don't do the Barry Manilow always take people on a journey where, you know, there's three acts, and, you know, that seems maybe a little much, but... just something where I feel like I'm maybe sharing some part of myself, but then hopefully it has a nice little melodic wrapper on it.
It has a melodic rap, but you're a master at writing melancholy melodies. Does that ever enter the picture consciously for you?
No, most of the melodies are pretty subconscious, I guess. I don't really spend a whole lot of time on them, actually. It's mainly, I probably spend about 20% of my time actually working out music, the actual notes and chord progressions, and about 80% of the time just working on lyrics and trying to have something to say.
Adam Levy, what's a good song?
It's got a nice beat and I can dance to it.
That sounds like Hookers and Blow, man. That's his cover band, by the way.
Yeah, and we get to play a lot of my favorite old songs in that band, so I feel like that's a nice barometer for things that I really like. A good song, a song that I feel means something to me, is a song that poses some sort of questions in it, examines something, whether it's a personal problem or something I see around me. I like the Barry Manilow idea of taking on an adventure. I don't see it as this like grand, you're going to go, I'm going to change you by listening to this song. Rather, it's like, I'm going to set up a little house, and you're going to come into my house, and you get to look at all these different rooms, and you're going to go into the bridge, and that's going to be another interesting room. And it's like, I feel like my songs are my babies, sort of. There's a lot of children that I have, and I know there's a lot of artists that produce huge amounts of records, and they probably don't like all the songs they've written, but I haven't written that many, so I feel like, you know, the songs that I've written, they're such a part of me that, you know, they feel like an extension.
You're so great at hooks, and I haven't heard you mention that at all.
Well, that's important. I think I've always kind of gravitated towards music that has, you know, nice cadences and melodies and harmonic ideas. But I also like to subvert that by examining something maybe that's a little darker that somebody might not expect in a sonorous setting. That I'm going to put something in your face, and you're just going to have to look at this and figure it out or sort it out or something.
What is the thing that has changed the most about your feelings on what a good song is over the course of your career, when you started out and now?
It's probably changed a lot because I felt like when I was writing songs at the early stage, the songs I tended to write were super autobiographical and almost embarrassingly hard on my sleeve. And people responded to that at that point.
They
and
sure
I felt
did.
Like that... You know, that's what it's all about. It's this kind of like brute connection that you have with people. And I think as time's gone on, I feel like it's more of, there's so many great, great, brilliant, brilliant songwriters and wonderful, simple songwriters. So what can I possibly add to this mix? And to me, it's the idea of like maybe playing a little bit with words and using them in a way that somebody might not have done, you know, even though they might have had a similar melodic idea, but I'm going to do something different with lyrics.
And you feel the same way about chord progressions, don't you?
Sure.
Is that difficult? Seems like there's only so many chords out there.
Right. And I think you just have to, you know, you, there actually are infinite combinations of those limited numbers of chords and huge numbers of melodic ideas. I'm always amazed when I hear a band playing a three-chord song that do a melody when you're like, wow, where did that come from? I've never heard that, even though it sounds somewhat familiar. So I feel like, you know, creativity is this boundless resource. It's just going to keep going.
Steph, what are the key ingredients in a great POS song?
The key ingredients in a great POS song. I guess to me, the key ingredients to a great song and a great POS song are almost exactly opposite, I think. Like, all of the songs I like to listen to and the songs that I really care about are, like, structured in a way that's easy to grab onto. And even if it's not easy to grab onto, there's something that catches you. There's, like, a line that sticks out, or the chorus is mega catchy, or, like, the beat's out of control. I don't know. There's always, like, the obvious thing to where, I don't know, maybe it's really either easy to put on and ignore, or it... you can't help but listen to it, and anywhere in the middle is not a great song. For my songs, when I was first starting, it was about trying to find the best way to do those two things. And nowadays, my favorite part about my songs is making them just really difficult to listen to. Like, all of my favorite elements in, like, the last batch of POS songs are... the beats being too loud to rap to, or the lyrics being too dense to enjoy the first time through. Like, I don't know. I found myself in a position where I figured out how to make a good poppy, catchy hip hop song, and then as soon as I figured out how to make a good poppy, catchy hip hop song, I was bored and didn't want to make any more poppy, catchy hip hop songs. So,
do you think you'll ever go back, man?
I mean, most likely, because I don't intend to not make songs ever. So, I mean, I can't just, you know, I figure, I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
You are. Okay. Absolutely.
Ask so, the part.
You want complexity, and you want the listener to be challenged. Why? Do you think that's ultimately more rewarding for the listener in the long run?
Yeah,
or do you even care about that?
I do care about that, but I care about it in a different way. I can't write awesome songs like these guys. I mean, that song you just played a second ago, Jeremy, was like the prettiest, coolest, like just a dude and a guitar.
Thanks.
Yeah, like, seriously, and it's a really pretty voice and really, like, so few words, you know what I'm saying? So few words in a rock song. It's amazing to me. And with a rap song, if you have a few words, you're rapping in a really boring style, I think, you know? And I just want to cram. I mean, there's so much easy to grab onto hip-hop and choruses and catchy and whatever, and I just really don't like it right now, and I just want to just kind of cram as much as I possibly can into, and then just kind of smooth it out, and then, meh.
Okay. Thanks, Steph. Best Friends Forever. What makes a really great Best Friends Forever song, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I would just say, obviously, as we've mentioned, our songs are made to be danced to. And they feel good for the most part. But I think, you know, to comment on what Mr. Manilow said, there's a lot of songs that are just, they set up a groove, and then they just groove for 3 minutes, and they don't go anywhere. And that's not a good song at all. And I don't think any of our songs are like that. Maybe a couple. They're not our favorite songs. And I think my point is just that we're a rock band setup. You know, we have guitar, keyboard, drum, and bass. So... we're limited in that way to, you know, the history of those instruments. But I want to, in this band, like, I enjoy pushing that envelope a little bit and exploring, like, new and interesting sounds of that setup.
And so rhythms as well?
Definitely rhythms, obviously, yeah. And, you know, being
but
the
that's
drummer.
So hard for people to dance to, though.
That's my challenge, I believe, is that, you know, dance, everyone thinks that a dance rhythm is just boom-ch, boom-ch, boom-ch. but like that's so boring. Like POS is saying, like Steph is saying, come on. So yeah, I'm always trying to explore new interesting beats that are danceable, but not just you know, the old disco beat or whatever. Even though I love disco beats, like I'm crazy about them. You can always get people moving with a disco beat, but you know, I think we explore new sounds and new new varieties of the rock setup, sort of.
How do you like the stories that your compatriots Jess and Bree come up with?
Yeah, definitely love it. I mean, I think we have to not only explore the interesting sounds that we can make, but also lyrically, it's good to explore new realms of that. And I think just having this relationship of best friends is something fresh that, like, you know, they can talk about love stories, but they interact in a way where they both know so much about each other that they kind of have this back and forth that I think works really well in storytelling.
All right. I think it's time to open things up to the audience. Am I correct here? I think this is a good point to get your feelings, comments, questions on what makes a good song, and all you have to do is raise your hand, and one of our very helpful, kind producers will bring a microphone over to you. And POS, I think, is going to be moving into place at this point to do his song. Yes, I think he is. I just have a feeling that's going to happen momentarily. And then maybe what we can do is, when that happens, we can turn that around. Or maybe that's already happened. Okay, we're good. All right, good. So, audience, questions. What do you hate about pop music today? Let me put the question to you that way. What are the components of the great songs that you're hearing on, let's say, The Current? Oh, come now.
I guess, like, for me, what makes a great song is something that's interesting, like everybody has said already. I like a lot of, you know, seventh chords and used in interesting ways, and a combination of electronic elements with organic elements, and mixing them together in a way that hasn't been done before. Groups like Ladytron, for example, is somebody that I'm really interested in right now, and how they can tell a story, but they're telling a story that, you know, with a lot of visuals in the lyrics and things like that. But you know, those, to me, that's what's interesting in a good song.
What's your name?
Renee.
Renee, are you a songwriter? You sound like one.
I'm not. I'm a guitarist and a violinist, but not an actual songwriter.
What about pop music today do you not like?
Well, it's kind of the opposite of all that, you know. I mean, frankly, you know, a lot of shallow lyrics that don't really that they just don't really grab me. The sounds. I mean, I guess it's a lot of the lyrics that just are talking about things that don't interest me.
It sounds like you have a high bar. Do you have any guilty pleasure songs that you like?
I'm a total music snob. I'm the first one to admit that. And but I don't consider anything a guilty pleasure. I do enjoy Madonna, you know, and you know, I have no. There's no guilt about that for sure.
She'd be glad to hear that. How about somebody else? Yes.
What makes a good song for me is something that makes me stop, like, the blur of my life and actually be in the moment, like something that will just really make me pause and affect me makes a really good song for me.
How often does that happen?
Quite a bit. I mean, I listen to music a lot, and so it happens quite a bit.
What are some of the things that make you displeased about songs that you're hearing on the radio, let's say?
Well, with like most like generic pop music, it it gets trapped in my head to the point where it won't ever come out. And it drives me crazy in a bad way. Not like a good, catchy way, but like, oh my God, please get out. So.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Anybody else?
Oh, I just had a question about your inspiration. I was wondering if any of you have ever had a song come to you in a dream, or you wake up and there's a melody in your head and you're even wondering, did I make that up or have I heard that somewhere?
So fully formed in a dream.
Or even just the inspiration, maybe even the story of it in a dream.
Panel?
I have two songs like that, actually. One of them on my first record is called Gimme Gunshots, and I wrote the chorus on accident. And then when I revisited the chorus, I was like, there's no way that I wrote that. And then I asked my friends if they'd heard anything that sounded like it, and they all said no, so I went with it. And then the second one was the song POS During My Life. I had asleep at my girlfriend's house, and we had had an argument, and I couldn't sleep very well. And then when I finally fell asleep, I woke right up and got up and sneaked out of her bed and walked into the living room and got a notebook and sat on the floor and wrote that whole song, just like, pew. And it wasn't like it came to me all in my dream, but it was like, go. And then I went and wrote it from start to finish, just in one sitting, just fresh out of sleep.
So. Do you see those kind of songs as like divine gifts, where you're just the messenger?
No, I find those kind of songs as like, whoa, that was way too easy. It can't be good.
Are you usually wrong about that?
Usually,
are they usually good?
I don't make enough songs to be the judge of that. I make the songs, and if I actually get to the point where they're recorded, then that's how that one went. And if I don't think it's going to be a good song, I don't even finish writing it. And I definitely don't record it.
More audience comments or questions?
Oh, I think we have...
Yes, sir.
That just sparked a couple things for me that I'm wondering if other people on the panel have felt, where you've... something so simple, you come up with something so simple, you just think it can't be good, or it just happens so quickly that you wonder if this is going to be something that sticks, or...
Yeah, a lot of times ideas come easily, and then you think, well, if it came this easily, is it really worth it? And frankly, some things that you spend immense amounts of time are garbage. And things that are so spontaneous that you almost think they come from somewhere else, it's a great thing.
I totally agree. I think that like whenever the process becomes like this big, huge. I have a friend of mine who makes beats in the group Kill the Vultures. His name's Steven Lewis, or DJ Anatomy. When he was making beats for Odd Jobs, you'd go to his house on like a Monday, and he'd have like the drums and bass line of a beat playing, and then you'd go to his house on Thursday, and he'd be like, no shirt, listening to the same beat. He hadn't stopped it yet. Eating a can of like corn out of the can. And then he'll stop the beat after like 20 hours of listening to this beat, and then he'll add like a hi-hat, and then he'll turn it back on and listen to it for another like 3 days before he like works on it again. And that made great beats, but whenever it came to like, you know, like whenever he like, somebody hit him up like, hey, let me buy a beat off you, and he'd just like throw something together in like 20 minutes, it was like always this like, oh, I can't give this away. I just made this. And I feel like there is something to be said about like the giant process of work, when like the more huge labor you put into it, usually it just ends up being overthought and not as good as just the quicker stuff. But when it like pops right out, it always feels like it's no good for me anyway.
I think all this talk of beats has put us in the mood for a POS song. Can you lay one down for us, POS?
No.
please.
I didn't make this beat. Laserbeak made this beat. I arranged it. It's on this iPod here.
Ladies and gentlemen, POS.
Can I stay sitting? Is that cool? I'm going to stay sitting. I'm going to start over. Oh, no. Uh-oh. Okay, good. Okay. You could probably turn that down just a tiny bit back there.
It goes, $1 million baby girl in the lower middle class with a mag light right beneath her pillow. And though she's never been a boxer by choice, she's known to act oak. You'll never catch her a willow, nuh-uh. She the calm type. You see them small scars creeping down her arm, peeking from them long sleeves, right? She keeps them weak in the knees, but she stay out of sight. And when that school bell rings, it's goodnight, or might as well be. He never sees her around, but he looks for weeks now. He's been maybe tomorrow, but he's shook. You see the bruises and knees to please her, and he don't want to go home either. Gives her a look, they pass, copies down a poem from his school book. Gives it to her after hesitation, whoops his ass, she took it fast. Lost all sensation in her hands, braced herself gracefully, sturdy where she stands on some humble mumbling, passing the words, fumbling, nothing discouraging, just nerves. Drumming up the courage, something about skylines or bike rides or riverbeds. Something, something that he read, it caught her right beneath the armor. Cauterized thought of any blunt force trauma. Ain't no way that he could harm her, nuh-uh. Not him, not now or ever. But some souls won't keep riding till the cycle is broke, so we ain't gotta go for nothing alone. And when that curse leave a shell like a snake with fresh scales, some people seem to call that home. But some souls won't, we keep riding till the cycle is broke, and we ain't gotta go for nothing alone. It goes, she's in the weather the whole storm, hugging on her prince, his hands to skin warm. Quick out the door, no note, no forlorn, cause all they heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. But they couldn't seem to keep the swelling down. How they regret and ever letting out this third child born, but it's getting better now. Cozy sweater now, with her thumbs through the holes and her sleeves worn down, and her boy's similar. Noise minimal, toy criminal. Joy's simple when someone's found it in you. Somehow it boosts the individual. That blue is hue is mutual. They make love so gently. So afraid of each other's bruises. And sort of scared they can lose this trust. Bury the blues somewhere, it won't bear roots. But is this boy where the truth is? She's spooked, see, fruit never seemed to fall far from the useless branch that it's attached to. And quacks, if he's beat up, he's bound to smack you. She's down to step back now. If he ever got loud, she couldn't be proud of whatever she might do. But it's the first time she ever felt touched that didn't bring her to hush like something was being done to her. That unscrews her, she loosens with the booze. Her hinge can stay bent, addressing her dude's wounds, regressing to bedrooms where fools ignore don't. He's not one of them tools that screws nuts and bolts, and she know that. And she know that, but she holds back, and she hope that he see the way she flinch, cause it's knee-jerk to brace for attack, even if he's only rubbing her back. I mean, and even if it's like the deck has been stacked, it's not an act, he's really loving her back. It goes, never raise your hand. She says that with a grown-up's voice. I'm yours now, just like a child. Please don't be scared now. It clicks, the piece finally fits. I love you. They say that with they never raise your hand. He says that with a grown-up's voice. I'm yours now. She says it like a child. Don't be scared. It clicks, a piece finally fits. I love you. They say that when they snake with fresh scales. Some people seem to call that home. But some souls roam, we keep riding till the cycle is broke, and we ain't gotta go through nothing alone. And when that curse leave a shell like a snake with fresh scales, some people seem to call that home. But some souls roam, we keep riding till the cycle is broke, and we ain't gotta go through nothing alone. And when that curse leave a shell like a snake with fresh scales, some people seem to call that home. But some souls roam, we keep riding till the cycle is broke, and we ain't gotta go through nothing alone.
POS. It's weird to say that a song like that, which is pretty upsetting to listen to if you're listening to it closely, is really cool. You know, I'm kind of conflicted by the feelings I get.
That's the point there, Chris. No, I'm just it's not really, but you know, you just write. And then sometimes it works out as a cool song.
How did that come to you?
I was actually on tour with a very, 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 very poppy live band rap group called the Gym Class Heroes. And I don't know, watching their crowds were largely like 14, 15-year-olds up through like maybe early 20s. But like, if you played these shows, like right in the front row, you'd see like the youngest, blondest girls, and then toward the back of the room, you'd start to see, you know, it just got older as it went back in the room. But actually, playing this tour for like a month and just kind of seeing the different types of kids and the kind of products they're wearing and like
the Warped Tour and like little girls with like the scars all down her arms and like the black shirts and the dreary. I'm not trying to say I'm not dreary or whatever. It wasn't in high school, but like there's like a certain type of, you know, horrible that comes from like the My Chemical Romance fans. I don't know. Like just there's like a big group of kids that are just bummed out all the time because that's like the style, you know? And then I don't know, just watching them and kind of just kind of...
Do you feel like you're watching them kind of on the verge of self-destructing or something?
No, I just watched... I mean, I think it's a waste of time to spend all of high school just...
Being in that fantasy?
Mm-hmm. You know? And, like, just kind of... That song was made up because I saw a guy and a girl at one of these shows that were really young, and they kind of had that thing you can see when you see like a couple that's like they're really in love, you know, like they're really in love, and you can see it, especially like when they're young, you can really see it. And they were really young; they couldn't have been older than like 16 apiece, and they were just all over each other. But they were just both just beat up and like looked rotten, looked like they've had some really hard times. And I kind of just thought of there's this famous Notorious B.I.G. song called Kicking the Door, and the chorus of it goes, kicking the door, waving the 4-4, all they heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. And he goes by Big Papa, so he's not talking about a dad hitting somebody, he's talking about like him busting in your door and beating you up, you know. But I just wanted to kind of flip that line, and the entire song was kind of based off seeing those kids and then flipping that line to, you know, quick out the door instead of kicking the door. So his is kicking the door, waving the 4-4. All you heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. Mine is quick out the door, no note, no forlorn. All they heard was Papa, don't hit me no more. But they couldn't seem to keep the swelling down. And it was just, I don't know. And I originally wrote it to a really slow beat, and the song was just such drag that I actually pulled it from my record until Laserbeak, the guy who made that beat, gave me that beat, which is kind of an upbeat. It's got the big drums and all that stuff.
Yeah, it is. It does have the big drums, but one of the things I really like about it is you're sparing with the big drums. When the big drums come in, you start going like this, and you kind of stop listening because it's really infectious. It's like a badass beat. But you use it, I only remember, I think, a couple times.
Yeah,
and it could have come in so many more times.
And it's through the first verse is a 16 bar. It's like the standard like rap verse length, and it's the same length verse length as like typical rock songs. There's just more words, but you know, the drums are through that and then through the chorus, and then for the second verse, which is like 32 or something like that, a really long verse, in order to make it not get boring, we just thought we'd try dropping out the beat entirely. And Laserbeak was really good about building it so it starts off mellow and kind of like slowly adds, you know, strings and adds different stuff until it finally bursts into the last chorus. So
that's very, very cool.
Thanks, man.
All right. I think what we want to talk about now is this concept of muse. And it seems like when we were talking about whether songs are divine gifts or whether you're just in the zone and receptive and ready to move on a song when the inspiration hits you, I think to some extent that's muse, maybe. Maybe muse is just kind of a deep level of concentration. But we're going to talk about muse in just a few minutes. First, let's hear a tape cut.
Muse, give me a feeping break. Muse is fantasy. Man, muse is feeping pretend. Muse is phony, romantic bullshit.
Beep.
Yeah, like there's a beeping microscopic creature with wings, you know, third cousin of beeping Cupid or something. It flies over you when you're sleeping and drops some beep in your brain. Oh, here are your chords, G, D, A minor. That's bull beep. You're a songwriter, okay? And you sit down and you either fucking knock out a song or you don't. Muse has nothing to beep do with it. Muse is bullshit, so we turn it into a myth and f***ing hide behind it. Oh, my muse isn't with me. Oh, I can't find my muse. Beep that sheep. Muse is bullshit, bullshit, bullshit.
That was brilliant. There's a lot of deep truth to that. I was really drunk when I said that. Okay, muse. Does it exist? Best Friends Forever? Do you rely on your muse?
We don't rely on it. However, there are definitely things, muses out there that we could go after if we were hard up for a song. There are anti-muses, too, such as the month of November. The darkest month. I specifically remember trying to write songs in November and it not happening. One muse I can pinpoint is breaking out of our everyday routine, usually through travel, and going other places and meeting new people and experiencing new things. And by doing so, also having a lot of fun and having this kind of refreshing new outlook on our everyday lives. Usually we get a lot of inspiration from those experiences.
I don't know if you're in the minority when you say that in November it's really hard for you to write songs. It seems like sadness and depression are kind of what Minnesota songwriters rely on.
Not best friends forever. No, I could come out with some really sad, slow songs in November, but that wouldn't be good for the band, so we tuck those away.
I think we maybe write songs or parts of songs or lyrics in the dark months, but we don't wind up using them.
Until the sun comes
because
back
because they're
up.
Sad.
Oh, but because they're sad. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jeremy Messersmith, what does your muse look like? Can it take a human form?
It can. It certainly does sometime. I just want to say to Best Friends Forever, all those dreary songs, you can just pass them right over my way. It's my stock and trade over in this corner. A muse can be people. I don't know. If you'd asked me this question, 3 weeks ago, I don't know what I would have said, but I think just as a result of doing this whole songs from scratch thing, because I've always wondered, what is the... what is inspiration and where does it come from? And I think for myself, I kind of found out that for me, inspiration is about 99% desperation. And so I think need kind of drives me to write songs, and it can be, external or internal.
So you're what my high school teacher once called me, a put-off boy. You procrastinate.
Oh yeah, for sure. Well, but really, I'm working the whole time. It's just my subconscious, and then I only put in maybe a half hour of actual work right before the deadline. But I've been thinking about it for a while.
But you've never said out loud, "Thank you, Muse."
No, I don't think so. Anytime I've had a song kind of just pop into my head or anything like that, it's. It's usually not anything that I'm really all that thankful for. It's generally some, kind of really depressing song that's really easy to write.
Adam Levy, do you think there is such a thing as a muse? I mean, what we're tampering with here is a very romantic notion, the muse, and, how it feeds you. And there's a mystery there, and we don't want to dismantle that mystery, do we?
This project for me was definitely an anti-muse project in a lot of ways, because I feel like deadlines are antithetical to the muse visiting you. Occasionally, he or she is generous. By the way, my muse looks like John C. Reilly with wings, a naked John C. Reilly. they come when you least expect them, and they usually surprise the heck out of you. There's things that I write that I just, there's no way I could have written that. I have no idea where that came from. I don't know how I put those chords together. It's just like a sort of magical thing, like you open your head up to. There are other times where there's just like craftsmanship. I hate to use that word, but today I felt like I was really banging out a song. And hopefully there's a few moments in there that might sound muse-like, but this was a lot of work. And I was a dude that set this up. it's very unmuse-like for me, but... I do love the muse.
So when you have those magical moments where you don't know where it came from, that's the muse.
I think so.
Can a muse partially inspire a song? I mean, not
sure.
Fully.
Yeah, there are times where you are talking to somebody and you didn't... I could have had the same conversation with a person and not observed a songable moment in that exchange. You know what I mean? It's like you can... it's like sometimes there's something that just hits you. It's like, wow, that phrase that person used, turn it around, that is a song. That's a song idea right there. I could have had the same conversation the day before and something like that wouldn't have taken place. So I feel like there is this kind of serendipity that goes on.
So if somebody told you that, well, Adam, actually, there really isn't such a thing as muse. Songwriters are constantly thinking about melodies, constantly focusing on words, and they're in tune, sometimes more, sometimes less, but they're always receivers. And, you know, when you study really hard for an exam before you go to sleep, you tend to do pretty well on the exam the next day, and maybe that's what happens at night with songwriters. You're constantly thinking about it.
That's true, and I have had those moments where I've woken up from sleep and sat down at a piano or a guitar, and all of a sudden, like, these chords came together, and I was struggling with them, but maybe you should talk to somebody else now.
Steph, you want to take a crack at that? Is there a muse in your life?
Currently, no. I will say that, like, there are several things that you could say. You could, like, throw muse at, I guess. For me, I think, depending on the season, being a Minnesotan, like, hard. Like, I love it here, and I'm not moving ever unless I move someplace that's colder in the winter and hotter in the summer. No joke.
You like extremes.
Yeah, I think that it really depends on the season. You know, like, if I'm sitting down to write a record and it is November, that's just what that record's gonna sound like. It's gonna be a winter record. It's gonna be difficult. I mean, my record that's coming out next is a winter record, and I guarantee half the people that like the summer record before it are not gonna like it. But that's okay. I'm one of those people that fully embraces like the dark, dark, dark of winter or the hot, hot, horrible of summer. You know. Also, I guess another maybe more traditional way is, like, if you're in love or if you're, like, really happy, you could crank out love songs like crazy, or you could make songs that love would like. You know, like, that's how it usually works. There's already, like, an atmosphere rap group. So as far as, like, writing songs about girls, it's just one of those things that as a Minnesota rapper, you just don't do.
Because it's been done.
Because it's not only been done, it's been done close to as good as it's going to get for rap, or it's been done in that style, you know?
You're talking about atmosphere.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, atmosphere kind of worked out girl songs. So unless I have, like, a really hard, amazing, amazing, this needs to be written down, serious girl experience that needs to be a song, needs to be, isn't just like this'll work, but it needs to be a song, it's not gonna happen. But how a girl might inspire me is like she'll be a big fan of a band I've never heard of. And then instead of making a song that sounds like that band, I'll be like, well, these are the reasons why I like that band, so maybe I'll make a song that she'll be into. And this is all subconscious. I'm just saying it's a floating muse butterfly.
Really briefly, Steph, it didn't seem like the muse was, if there is such a thing, was operating on you during Songs from Scratch.
During Songs from Scratch, I like to let things steamroll, you know? So, like, my muse hit me a while back, and I was writing this winter record, and Songs from Scratch came up, and it was just like, all right, I'm still rolling. I'm still pregnant with ideas.
Nice phrase, man.
Since writing this record and stuff like that, so it wasn't a matter of needing a muse for me. Like if I'm inspired to make music, I will make music until I'm not inspired to make music anymore, and then I won't make music for a year. You know, I'll make beats and I'll sell those beats, or I'll like do guest verses or something like that, but I won't set out to make my own project stuff until I'm feeling like it's a good time to.
How much do your beats cost?
It depends on who you are.
All right, let's go back to the audience now, and your turn to ask these folks anything that's on your mind. Child rearing, politics, songwriting. Fire away. Here's your chance. Some of you may be fans and familiar with some of their songs, and you've been dying to know, what were you thinking when you wrote that?
When it comes to listening to music, do you find there's ever a point where you have to cut yourself off from listening with the worry that it could sort of be infecting your ideas, you might just be copying, or is it always an inspiration? Or there other people's music?
Who are you talking to?
Anybody.
I'll answer it. when I'm writing a record, I can't listen to music. If I know that I'm about to sit down, because I don't I'm really bad at writing songs. You know, like this is a song for no reason. You know, like I'm usually like I'm gonna make this chunk of what this chunk of time is like. So I got to do a bunch of songs. I usually do like batches of eight. But if I know that I'm feeling like I gotta write, I usually stop listening to at least rap.
I never write anything that sounds like anyone else ever. So, it's weird. It's like I'll go through these periods where I will literally like listen constantly to music, and then it will be, I won't want to listen to music. I'll turn on the radio to listen to 91.1 just to get away from music. But there are times where it's almost sort of random. You know, if I'm writing, I can be listening too, and I don't feel like I'm lifting ideas when I'm doing that. Usually, your band is pretty good at picking up on stuff if it sounds too similar to something else.
Hi. Well, I've written some songs, and it seems to me sometimes I'll have lots of melodies and no words, and other times I'll have lots of words and no melodies. And then every once in a while, I'll sort of dig around in the junk bucket and find some words, and I'll go, hey, maybe that goes with this melody over there, and I'll create the Frankenstein monster song where they were never intended to be together. And I guess, how often have you done that, and do you feel like the melody has to go with the words that were meant for that melody, or is, you know, do you do the same kind of crazy thing that I do?
I'll take that. I have kind of like a few things that I keep written down, sort of rattling around, some melodies, some lyrics, and I've made a few Frankenstein songs. Not that one just now where I sang about Frankenstein, but that isn't one. But most of the time, they don't work for me, and they don't work because usually it's kind of two separate ideas, so... I usually have a better time matching, like, say, lyrics with some melody, but not two lyrical ideas and putting them together. So normally what I'll do is I'll take, you know, the lyrics, match it with the melody, and then I'll try to write organically from that part. So kind of treat that as just kind of the seed and then try to, you know, sort of grow the plant song weird metaphor.
I think in a rap situation, that works really well. Like if it's you're in the studio and your buddy's like, hey, you want to put a verse on this song? It's really easy to just go through text messages and find little pieces that are relatable, and then just fill in the gaps between where they would go in the thing. But yeah, that works good. And yeah, we call them Frankensteins too. And also, there's like my roommates think I'm crazy. I'm just in my house like rapping rap patterns with no words, just kind of like estimates. And then I'll do that, and then I'll find words or go through old text messages. I seriously have 1,552 emails to myself that I can go through and like pick lines to try and make them fit in the chunks.
I have a question about rhymes. POS, I know you'll rhyme almost every syllable in a line sometimes, but BFF, sometimes you're not rhyming at all, and I'm wondering how much rhymes will drive a lyric for or a whole song, I guess.
Well, I guess I would comment that it can go either way. Like, in my experience with the band and outside of the band, like, rhymes can either inspire an artist and force something new and creative out of them, or they can also just restrict them. So I think probably everyone here would say the same. So sometimes we use rhymes, sometimes we don't. When you're feeling the rhyme, like it can really bring some new cool stuff out. But you don't want to just use rhymes for the sake of using rhymes, yeah, because it makes it easier for other people to sing along with your songs. Like, that's not good enough.
Yeah. That's what were you going to say? You should say. that's kind of where the rhyming every syllable thing happens in rap, is because it gets really boring rhyming the last word, and it just sounds silly. So my challenge oftentimes is trying to figure out how not to rhyme and still have it be hip hop. And like that means like putting off the rhyming word to like the end of a bar. I wish I had some like examples right off the top of my head, but like you can set up with the first word of like a four line thing will be like time, and then go a whole bar, and then where you think the rhyme will gonna be next, you can just kind of like flip the pattern, and then have the last word of like a four bar be the rhyme for the first word. I don't know, it happens all over, it's great, but it is a total, it does come up, like you feel restricted having to rhyme all the time as a rapper, so you want to like bend that around.
I guess this is mainly for BFF and Steph, is both of y'all seem to be interested in stretching the limits of the pop form. And Steph, you talked about, you know, sort of rapping in and around the beat and adding extra syllables to it. And BFF, you guys play a lot with discord and coming, you know, back in and around to the melody, and all, you know, and sort of singing around the time signature that you throw down. And so I'm curious, like, how playing with that works for you in the songwriting process, in terms of pushing it but not making it unlistenable, you know, so you don't end up in like Fiery Furnaces early stuff land where you have like five different ideas going on at once and you're calling it a song but it's, you know, not really a song.
I think we want to write music that we enjoy playing, especially when we play every night for a month. We want to write music that is challenging to us, so I think we don't set out to stretch limits. I think it just happens when we're working on a song together.
Math rock?
Oh yeah, we used to be really stretching things and very anti catchy pop music. We've come over to pop music
a very long time
ago. but I was gonna also say, like you said, we still try to make it listenable, and that is an important thing for us too. That we are, and I think we know when we've crossed the line and might step back and say, rearrange it to be keeping it poppier. Joe, you want to chime in?
I just wanted to add that as performing artists, I feel like live performance is a good gauge of that, and we'll work on a song and then play it at a show. And we really do pay attention to the audience, because you can really tell like if they're feeling it or not. And that could be because of the discord that we have going on, or maybe it's just not a happening song.
I don't know anybody that doesn't like their band. It's because even if they don't like the songs, they can tell that everything that's going on is really fun. Do you know what I'm saying? Like that's like an awesome thing. As far as I'm concerned, I like to make it for this last few batches of songs we're making. I've been trying to make a beat and then turn everything up until it doesn't sound good anymore, and then turn it down a little bit. So that's where I'm at with that.
Do you ever go back and revisit old songs that you worked on that you might have finished recording already, maybe even released on an album, and then think, okay, now I would do the lyrics differently, or I would change something up and just completely rewrite it? Or are you so sick of that song by the time you've performed it for 3 years and spent months and months working on it?
I always say when the baby is out, you can't stuff it back in. And that's a horrible image, but... If it's out in the public, I mean, if it's like recorded and done, I'm just, you know, that's like a done deal. But there are songs that are sitting around, just like this gentleman over here asked that, you know, do you ever patch together things? There's songs that I'll deliberately like cannibalize something old and put it on something to fit with what's new now.
Okay, good questions.
No way, she hasn't answered.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I had to. Go ahead.
Excuse me, Jess.
I was just
going
to say that I. Oh, I think sometimes being so sick of a song leads to us going back in and reworking it, if not just to keep ourselves entertained, because like Brie was saying, playing the same song every night for a month just makes us naturally start to change it. And sometimes it's not always to the benefit of the song. Sometimes it's... we have to remind ourselves that if we're in different cities every night, we're playing for people that have never heard it before or have heard it the way it is on the album and want to hear it that way. So we have to hold back from improvising or changing it. But we definitely have songs that we wrote 4 years ago that we go back in and change. I think we have one or two songs that we've actually re-recorded too.
When we don't have a lot of songs, so the ones we have, we've put a lot of work into. So when we get to the point where we think we aren't liking it so much, it's hard to just let it go and have all that work be for nothing. So even this has happened. We've had it recorded. For us, it's a little more flexible that we can stuff the baby back in.
All right, we're going to move on. I see the sun is kind of setting very beautifully, or a reflection of some orb out in the sky out there. We have a really kind of provocative piece of tape that we want to play for you. This is none other than Paul Simon. He was on Mid-Morning a couple of years ago, and I think he agreed to be interviewed by Carrie Miller in his trailer before a show. And he had something that I think is really interesting, and I want to get your opinion on it, panel. So let's take a listen.
After the initial rush of songs in a songwriter's career, I think you've sort of spent your natural melodic capital, so to speak. And now you've got to go and, now you got to go earn it.
Now that's really interesting to me because in a way it kind of explains Paul Simon's globe hopping and appropriating musics from other cultures. I'm putting words in his mouth right now, but maybe that's the reason he did it. He felt like, at least rhythmically and melodically, his well was empty. Do you think there is a limited amount of creativity that everybody has and it's going to dry up at some point, songwriters? Jeremy.
I don't know, actually. I was just thinking about, I heard an interview with Bob Dylan, and he kind of said some similar stuff about how he can't write songs like the way he used to, and so he doesn't even really try to write songs like that anymore. So it kind of makes me feel a little sorry for Paul Simon, though. It's like I wish he had a lot more capital to spend.
He sounded kind of depressed.
Yeah, he sounded like, well, you know, these are the great songs I wrote back then, but I couldn't possibly write them now. Now I'm,
so
I don't know.
Maybe it's songwriters who are really staring mortality in the face, you know, and they feel like my well is empty, I have nothing left to offer. Do you guys think your well will ever run dry, or do you just feel like it's endless? Our creative energy knows no bounds.
I think we actually think every time we finish a song, we're worried that the well is dry. And so when the well is...
And amazed
when the
that
muse comes, yeah, we finish a song, we're like, oh, we'll never do that. And this is the last song, the muse comes, and we get another song. And so we're grateful for everyone.
There's that muse again, man.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Wow.
I imagine that if you have spent your whole life writing songs, and especially being somebody like Paul Simon or Bob Dylan, being expected to be churning out all these songs, if that's your whole experience writing songs, I feel like there would be a point where it would be hard to keep writing. I mean, what do you write songs about? Writing songs.
Interesting. POS?
I think it depends. I think a lot of people get into writing songs. They write some songs, and then the songs they wrote were popular, and then they get really stuck in that idea that, like, this is what works for me, you know? And they sit around and they wait for their hit record before they get experimental. But I feel like if anybody came up to me, like, at the merch table and was like, dude, it's over, right? You don't have any more songs, I'd punch them in their head. Like, I mean, I think you're, growing up, I whenever somebody said they couldn't write a song or they couldn't play guitar or something like that, I'd be like, you're kidding, right? Like, anybody can do that. It's a thing that you can learn to do. And if somebody doesn't like that song, it's because they don't like that song. Do you like it? Did you write it? It's yours. You know what I'm saying? Like, and sticking to that vibe is what makes me feel like every album I make can be entirely different And if it doesn't have like the pop gem masterpiece, I'm not going to trip if you're not, you know? Like, I don't think that anybody's creative will goes dead unless they really set themselves up to only do one thing ever.
Adam Levy, is your well overflowing? Are you into well maintenance right now or dryness?
My well needs a plunger right now. Every time I finish a record, my feeling is always like, oh, I'm done. I'm never going to be able to write another song. And I always seem to be able to push myself somehow, something happens. And I feel like with a Bob Dylan, there's a certain point, I think, where you just kind of give up on pushing the envelope a little bit. That's just my opinion. And I still feel young, and I still feel like I'm sort of learning what I'm doing and getting a handle on it after 9 records. And I'll push myself longer, but there'll probably come a point where it's like, oh, I don't care. I'll just, like, write any lyrics. It won't matter how I construct the songs. They'll probably sound like the old songs that I wrote, which is what I think Dylan's records are starting to sound like. But at this point, I care, and I think when you care, that drives the creativity.
Oh, good point. You're about to play a song right now, and before you do, I wanted to ask you a question that POS alluded to just a little bit ago. Do you think songwriting is something that can be taught or learned, or is it just completely innate?
I think, you know, people go to school to learn literature. There's great writers who have gone to school, and they learned all of the kind of technical competencies of what a writer is, you know, how you construct the perfect sentence and so forth. But I don't think the creativity part of it is something that you can really teach to people. But you can learn to become a better songwriter. I can't think of any of the great songwriters you can't see this noticeable evolution of, like, the Beatles from their first record to the last record they put out. You know, there is a growth that happens. And for that reason, I think it's something that can be learned. It's not just about, I mean, there are certainly geniuses in the world where it's easier for them. But there's also people who are not virtuosic in their sense of music theory that write absolutely incredibly cool songs that are moving or, you know, powerful in some sort of way.
Somebody who wants to dabble in songwriting comes to you and says, what should I do first? How do I go about this? How would you answer?
Well, write what you know is sort of the classic, you know, the classic get started, you know, rule of thumb. I think just thinking about things in your life that are meaningful to you and being able to stand behind that somehow.
All right. Well, I think I'm going to bring things full circle. We started out talking about songs from scratch. I think I vaguely remember me dissing that in some way. I didn't mean to if I did. But we're full circle. Adam came up with the story idea, The Wizard of Oz. He wrote some lyrics, and all of these guys took it and ran with it and did wonderful work. And now, Adam, you've written something, haven't you?
I did, but I was listening to that radio thing yesterday trying to write in the last minute like the procrastinator that I am. And I was going to call Larissa up and say, I'm sorry, I can't do this. I can't finish this song. And this morning, I worked on this some more, and I guess the muse sort of arrived at the last minute or something. But I used it. The song is it's called Mesopotamian Cleanse, and the idea came.
It seems
from,
like we're moving away from Kansas with that.
Yeah, the core is still in there, but I've just been thinking a lot lately. There's a young woman who's renting from me, and our politics are very similar in some ways. But she said, "I don't think that we should be involved in anything in the world until we get rid of the sickness in ourselves here." And it made me bristle because I thought, well, certainly that's part of the process. We need to work on ourselves, and then we can sort of be better people. But I guess I see it as a more kind of holistic thing. And so this song is sort of about that debate in my head.
Don't you want to hear it? All right, let's put your hands together for Adam Levy.
We
We all need a warm body in a cold universe. Rugged individuals and traffic inerts. But we don't like our bodies. We wish we could be someone else. With piles of white sugar, motherboards and hunger will drive the beast out. Twisted and sprung, no life in our lungs. The bait and the switch of a cyber heartbeat song. They sing from the ends of the earth to your own backyard. Mouth and mind drink everything, but they can't fill an empty heart. The king and his court demand a Mesopotamian cleanse. Turn a kingdom into a desert, then call it peace. Twisted and sprung, no life in our lungs. They're saved from the ends of the earth to your own backyard. Mouth and mind, everything, can't fill an empty heart. Mama steel, energy and matter. Breathe. I'm gonna try that bridge again. It's all energy and matter. Namaste and Om. Myriad formulas and nostrums, prayers, all roads lead home. Industrious bones, drinking fine coterones. Uncle's death knell is near. The rise of the rest, well, they won't just catch up. They'll pass us with jeers. They're twisted and sprung, life in their lungs. Bait and switch of the cyber harpy's song. They twisted and sprung, no life in their lungs. The bait and switch of the cyber harpy's song. From the ends of the earth your own backyard. Mouth and mind drink everything, but they can't fill an empty heart. From the ends of the earth to your own backyard. Mouth and mind drink everything, but they can't fill an empty heart.
Mesopotamian Cleanse, brand new song from scratch from Adam Levy. Adam, what's going on with the Honey Dogs right now?
We're starting to record a new record, and we're getting ready to help put on a big show called Provention at the time of the Republican National Convention. It's kind of a counterpoint to the Republican National Convention. Got a lot of bands playing, and we're getting involved with a lot of progressive issue folks.
So Midway Stadium?
No, actually, it's not Midway Stadium. It's going to be at O'Gara's on the 31st of August. Lots of bands, so it's going to be fun.
Great. Jeremy Messersmith, what's going on with you?
I've got a new record coming out in a couple of months, and I'll be hitting the road probably for about 2 or 3 months in the fall.
POS, we due for a blowout soon?
Blowouts are only in December, Chris. But yes, we're going to do another one. But
I'm referring to, yeah, Doomtree.
Sorry. Yeah, Doomtree is my rap group. We have a big show every winter, kind of celebrating the fact that we live in an ice cold, horrible tundra. Last year we had people passing out hot cocoa to the people on the line waiting, and we had a band that played in my van for the line while they waited. But we have our first album comes out on Tuesday, and we have a CD release show on Friday at First Ave.
Great. Best friends.
Forever.
What up?
Tomorrow we embark on our tour. So if anyone is up for a drive to Spearfish, South Dakota, they can follow us over there. And if you're not doing anything for the whole month of August, you're welcome. You know, come along. Caravan.
Best of luck to you, BFF. Everybody else, thank you, you guys. What a magnificent panel. It was really informative and interesting and entertaining. And thank you all so much for coming.